according to the police officer I spoke to, they went through a list of questions in order to ascertain whether or not she was safe and determined that she was okay to be on her own on the streets of Victoria, barefoot in November, and they left her there. That was the last time anyone ever saw her.
You are listening to Emma Filipov is Missing, an ongoing series by the Nighttime Podcast.
Filled with equal parts mystery and heartbreak, tonight's story is as much about the strength of a mother's love as it is about the fragility of the human mind. Our topic tonight is the still unexplained disappearance of 26-year-old Emma Filipov, who was last seen by the police officers who left her standing barefoot on a busy intersection in Victoria, British Columbia on a cold night in November of 2012. For the last 4 years, the events surrounding Emma's disappearance have been pored over by police, private investigators, a swarm of amateur detectives, and most of all by her mother, Shelley Filipov, who's been leading a relentless search for her missing daughter since she arrived at Emma's last known address to check on her well-being. Tragically, Shelley arrived just 3 hours after her daughter's last known sighting. Tonight's episode will be the first in a series I plan to produce covering the disappearance of Emma Filipov. In the next hour, you will hear a timeline of and background on the events leading to Emma's sudden disappearance, all told via excerpts of an emotionally charged interview with the driving force behind the search for Emma. She'll introduce herself now.
My name is Shelley Filipov, and I'm Emma Filipov's mom. I've been looking for my daughter for almost 4 years now, since November 28, 2012.
When Shelley and I began our conversation, we started with a discussion surrounding who Emma is as an individual. Prior to my talk with Shelley, everything I had learned about her daughter made it obvious Emma was a unique person. She was very artistic and, of course, strikingly beautiful. Here's a bit of how Shelley described her daughter, Emma.
Emma's personality is simply lovely. She's compassionate, she's kind, she's creative, she's talented, she's intelligent, she's funny. People are very drawn to her because she just has that type of personality that makes you want to get to know her. She's an animal lover, she's an advocate for the underdog. She's just an all-around lovely person, and I know that sounds like a mother speaking, and it is a mother speaking, but people that know Emma, who have even just met Emma briefly, become quickly aware of exactly what this young woman has to offer the world.
Having now been introduced to Emma in a basic sense, our narrative will begin with Emma living in her hometown of Perth, Ontario, soon to make her move to Victoria, British Columbia.
Yeah, she was living in Perth. She was living with her dad. She had come home from the West Coast because she has a congenital knee problem and she wanted to see her own orthopedic surgeon. So that was initially the reason she came home. Once she got home, she realized she wanted to stay around for a while, which she did. So she let go of her position in Campbell River, where she was a chef at one of the local pubs. And so she stayed in Perth, and she essentially just hung out. She did a lot of drawing, a lot of painting, a lot of photography, spent time with friends that she hadn't seen for a long time, and that kind of thing.
As you just heard Shelley describe, Emma was living a fairly typical life, despite having her eccentricities. But to those close to her, it seemed as if she was in the middle of finding her unique way through life. It's at this point where Emma would make her move from Perth, Ontario to Victoria, BC. Shelley told me about Emma making this move and what Emma was planning to do there.
Well, her plan was to return to the West Coast. She loves the West Coast. So her plan eventually was to return, and she really debated. She wasn't sure where on the West Coast she would go. She knew she would go to BC. She didn't want to go back to Campbell River. So she just, I think, kind of arbitrarily chose Victoria. And she went without a job. She went in the hopes of finding something when she got there.
Those close to Emma would realize only after it was too late that Emma's time in Vancouver was not as it appeared to be on its surface. Over time, she seemed to be reducing the amount of contact she had with her family and friends back home, and what communication she did have with them left some room for interpretation.
Well, with Emma was primarily in touch via email. She was not a believer in technology per se, so she absolutely refused to have a cell phone. So she didn't have a cell phone, which made it very, very difficult for her to get a hold of us by phone. She'd have to use a pay phone to call. So she tended to stay in touch via emails. So she emailed friends and she emailed us, and I'd say she emailed me probably at least once a month. So her emails were always light and airy. Some were even cryptic, many of them poetic, not your standard email. They were always very beautiful. When I look back on them now, I see that there were messages there that I would never have been able to pick up on at the time. I see them now. At the time, they just seem poetic and somewhat cryptic, but very, very beautiful and very poetic and very happy. The tone of every email was happy.
We will next get to the first obvious indications that Emma was in some sort of distress. In the days prior to Emma's disappearance, a series of phone calls would be made by Emma to her mother Shelley that would make it clear something was going very wrong in Emma's life. Shelley described these phone calls to me when we spoke.
Well, I received a phone call on a Friday evening, Friday night, late actually. It was almost early Saturday morning. It was around midnight, and Emma called, and she was in tears, telling me that she wanted to come home. She was very distressed, so I didn't want to further distress her by asking her questions, so I didn't ask her what was wrong. I just said, well, absolutely, you know, of course you can come home. What I'll do is I will go in to my laptop and book you a knee ticket, and it'll be waiting for you at the airport, and just we'll meet you at the airport, and then we'll go from there. And she cried even harder and seemed to become more distressed and asked that I come to Victoria to help her come home. She said she wasn't in any shape to travel on her own or to pack up her things and come home on her own. So I said that I would book a ticket then, and that I would be there within roughly 12 hours. So that seemed to appease her a bit, and we talked a little bit longer, and I said, you know, let me know when you want to hang up, whenever you're ready to end this conversation. I said, if you want to stay on the phone all night, that's fine. So she calmed down somewhat. She was still sobbing, but she calmed down and she said, okay, so I will see you for sure tomorrow. And I said, absolutely, I'll see you tomorrow, which was Saturday. Saturday morning, mid-morning, I got a phone call from Emma, again distraught, saying, I've changed my mind, I was just having a bad day, I think I can handle things on my own, I think I can cope, please cancel your ticket and don't come. So I proceeded to cancel my ticket. By now I'm extremely concerned. I'm talking to the other members of our family, and they're urging me to respect her last wish, which was for me not to go. Then that Saturday night I got another phone call, and it was Emma, and she was very distressed, and it was, please come and help me. I need help. I want to come home. So I went through the same routine. I booked a ticket and packed, and I got a ticket ready for Sunday. And again, I told her, you know, I would be roughly 12 hours to get there. And by then Monday, I received another phone call, Jordan, and it was, don't come. It was, I'm going to figure this out. I'm going to be fine. But at no time did she sound as if she were fine. Again, I talked to the other family members. I talked to her siblings. I talked to her dad, and they said, you know, you've got to respect your privacy. And her last wish is always, don't come. So, Mom, you need to listen to that. It really went against the grain for me. It went against my gut instinct. But I put a lot of stock in my other children, and knowing their sibling probably better than I might know her. So I followed their advice. By Wednesday morning, I had received the last phone call, so that would be the last time I spoke to her. And she said, don't come today. Don't come, Mom, not today. And that was the last time I spoke to her.
As you heard in the last clip, the calls themselves were very concerning, but the discovery of where the calls were originating from really put Shelley in a state of panic. I asked Shelley what led her to realize that Emma was staying in a woman's shelter.
Well, one of the phone calls was definitely from a phone booth because she reversed the charges. So I didn't think anything of that. And as I said, she never had a cell phone. But then the subsequent calls came from the name that would come up on call display was Sandy Merriman. And the first couple of times I assumed that that was someone's name and that that was the person that she was living with. So at first it didn't occur to me to think anything of it, but I think it was on the third call, I thought, I'm going to call this number back and see if I can get Emma. So when I called, they answered and they said this was the Sandy Merriman Shelter for Women, and I was just in shock. I didn't have any idea that Emma had been staying at a woman's shelter. So I was overwhelmed. I was really overwhelmed. Find out that that's where she had been staying.
After the final call, it was clear to Shelley that her presence was required in Victoria, with or without Emma specifically requesting it. It's at this point Shelley makes the decision to go to Victoria and check on Emma's well-being in person, without Emma knowing she was on her way. As the day of the 28th started, Shelley was home getting packed and preparing to make her way to Victoria for a short trip to collect her daughter. However, in Victoria, Emma's day would start with her seemingly planning something. Based on the timeline Shelley's Help Find Emma team had been able to put together, one of the first steps in Emma's day was an 8:23 a.m. visit to a downtown Victoria 7-Eleven store. The surveillance video showing Emma acting unusual in this visit is widely circulated.
So she went in there and she purchased this prepaid credit card, which, you know, in retrospect seems odd because she had a debit card, but anyhow, she purchased it. But then she was very reluctant to leave the store. If you look at the footage, she walks back and forth and she peers out and she holds her hands up to the glass so as to block out any shadow so that she can see outside. And it looked as if she was watching for somebody, but her actions, her movements, her gestures were very nervous, seemed very tense. So I don't think she was waiting for a friend. I think she was concerned that there was somebody out there. That at least that's what I got from looking at the footage. I mean, later on when I discovered more about her mental state, then it could have been her own way of thinking. But definitely the vibe that I got from Emma in the store was that she was very, very nervous and she was afraid to go back outside.
The next confirmed sighting of Emma was in the early evening hours at 5:54 p.m. In this case, she returned to the same 7-Eleven store where she purchased the prepaid credit card. Again, Emma made an out-of-character purchase and seemed reluctant to leave the store.
One thing that stands out is she's buying a prepaid cell phone. She's never owned a cell phone in her life, so that makes me really question why she was buying a cell phone. And again, she's extremely hesitant to leave the store. She paces back and forth, and she looks out, and she holds her hand up again to block out shadow so that she can really see who's out there. Again, very tense, almost jittery in her movements. Emma has a very fluid way of moving. She moves, well, she was a dancer and she moves like a dancer. And she certainly wasn't moving like a dancer that night. She was hesitant. She seemed scared to me, Jordan. She seemed afraid.
As Shelley was beginning to board her flight to Victoria, Emma was clearly planning something. She now had in her possession a prepaid credit card and a pay-as-you-go cell phone. Emma's next action would create even more questions and ultimately start the chain of events that will end with her disappearance. Only 15 minutes after buying the cell phone, it now being 6:10 p.m., Emma will flag down a taxi cab.
Okay, well, to the best of my knowledge, she hails a cab. She gets in the cab and she asks to go to the airport. She proceeds to ask the cab driver how much it'll cost to go, and he said that it would be $60. So she said, oh, that's too much, I can't afford it. Well, we since know that she got a prepaid credit card for $200 and that she had money in her bank account, so she could in fact afford it, but she says she can't. So she asks him to drop her off, but what's very bizarre is that she wants to stay in the car and go around the block and have him drop her off at exactly the point where he picked her up. And then when he gets to that point where he had picked her up, she doesn't want to get out of the car. She asks if she can stay and sit for a little while in the car. And he says, well, you know, I've got to work. And said, oh, if I could just stay with you, if I could just sit here for a few minutes. And then she reacts to the radio. Now, I don't know if it's the radio or his taxi radio system, but she hears something coming out, some sounds coming out, and she asks him what that is, again, as if there seems to be some type of paranoia at play here. After a couple of minutes, he insists that, of course, that she has to get out, and she does, and then she does get out of the taxi.
Shortly after getting out of the cab in front of a busy downtown hotel called the Empress, Emma would run into an acquaintance that she had met at a library she was known to frequent. This encounter and this acquaintance's concern for Emma would lead to the Victoria Police's involvement in Emma's disappearance. Shelley will walk us through this now.
Well, the acquaintance is a young man named Dennis Quay. He ran into Emma and was really happy to see her. He had only met her once. Again, there's an example of how people love to be around Emma, because he had only met her once in the library, and yet when he saw her, he told me that he was just so excited to see her. He said at first she didn't seem to recognize me, and he found that odd, because they had spent hours poring over books on Japan, because she was interested in traveling to Japan. I believe he was interested in learning Japanese. So they, even though they'd only had that one encounter prior to this one, they had spent a number of hours together. So he was really surprised, and he said she was just so different than the Emma that he had met and spent time with in the library. So he just kind of stayed with her and tried to engage her in conversation. And eventually she asks him if he would walk with her, and he said yes, of course. So they spent some time walking together. There was some construction outside the Empress Hotel, and they were going to walk past the Empress in that direction. But when they get to the construction, the alleyway that's been constructed with a roof over it, Dennis said that Emma was very afraid to enter, even though it was well lit, that Emma was very afraid to enter into this makeshift walkway. And she put her hands out as if to feel or something, and didn't want to walk through it. So he continued with staying with her and talking to her as much as he could. She was pretty non-responsive, he said. So after about an hour of time spent with her, he decided there was something seriously wrong. He ruled out drugs. I'm not sure what he based that on, but he said definitely I didn't think that she was stoned, that she was on drugs. He said, I thought there was something else really wrong. So that's when he called. He didn't have a cell phone himself, so he stepped into a little restaurant on the corner and used their phone and called 911. And then he waited, watching her. He didn't go back to her. He didn't actually say it, but I think he didn't want her to associate him with having called the police. He just watched from across the street and made sure that she was okay and waited till the police arrived. And when the police arrived, he left.
As Shelley Philippoff is taking her seat on her flight to Victoria, police are responding to the call from Emma's acquaintance, Dennis Quay. Victoria police would find Emma standing in front of the Empress Hotel, barefoot, clutching her shoes on a cold November night. As the police approach her, Dennis Quay leaves the scene, now believing she had the help that she needed.
They arrived, I believe, there at about 7:17, and according to the police that I spoke to, the police officer that I spoke to, they went through a list of questions that are customarily asked when they face a situation like this, when there's someone that seems in distress or is on the street, as Emma was. So they claim that they asked all the right questions in order to ascertain whether or not she was safe. I was told that they asked her questions such as, are you suicidal? Or do you feel that you're going to harm yourself? Do you feel that you're going to harm someone else? Have you eaten? Do you have a place to stay? And apparently she just nodded. or shook her head, that she didn't actually speak. And they spent about 45 minutes with her and determined that she was okay to be on her own in on the streets of Victoria, barefoot in November, and they left her there. That was the last time anyone ever saw her.
As the two Victoria police officers leave the scene and leave Emma still standing in front of the Empress Hotel, there's yet to have been another confirmed sighting of her. What Emma said to police or what led to their decision to not intervene is still unknown, as despite her great effort, Shelley has been unable to access detailed information from the police report. In another cruel twist in this story, Shelley's flight would touch down in Victoria just 3 hours after Emma was questioned by the Victoria police. As Shelley arrived, she proceeded directly to the Sandra Merriman shelter where she expected Emma to be staying. When she showed up to the shelter, the situation went from bad to worse.
Well, I arrived at 11 p.m. They let me in and I explained who I was. And they said, we're sorry, Emma's not here. And I was very disappointed, but I wasn't alerted to anything because I thought, well, she could easily be staying at a friend's house. I wasn't shocked or overly surprised. Really, my feeling was one of disappointment. So I said, well, any idea where she is? And they said, no, she's missed curfew. She's missed the chance at her bed, so she's probably staying at a friend's house. But then the supervisor suggested that we go up to her office and that we talk. So then some bells went off, and I thought, okay, so it's not just a fact that Emma's staying over at a friend, something else is going on here. So she took me to her office and she went on to explain that Emma hadn't been herself for the last 2 weeks and they had been extremely concerned about her. And I explained about the phone calls and they said, yes, we were aware of those because all but one or two she had made from their office. And it required a staff member to be present in the office when someone was making a phone call. So they overheard the phone conversations. So we talked for about an hour. They gave me some description. They were very cautious. They were very aware of the privacy laws, so they weren't willing to tell me much. But by midnight, the supervisor thought that it would be a good idea to call the police and have her considered a missing person. Then a lot of bells went off, Jordan. Then I thought, they know a lot more than they're letting on, and there's something seriously wrong here.
Shelley's arrival to the shelter and the realization that Emma wasn't there would mark the first moments of her search. When we spoke, Shelley discussed the first moments in this search, which is sadly now entering its fourth year.
Fortunately, there was a hotel directly across the street from the shelter, so I went over there around 2 a.m., 3 a.m., and they had a room for me, so I asked for a room that overlooked the shelter, and they had one, so I took that one at the front of the hotel so that I could watch the shelter, and I thought I could actually sit on the bed and watch the front door of the shelter, and I thought, well, I can just watch. I can sit here tonight and watch to see if she does show up. Even though I'd been told that she had missed curfew and she wasn't entitled to a bed, I thought she still might show up, and surely to goodness they would let her in. They wouldn't just turn her away. But no such luck, she didn't turn up. So it just never occurred to me, Jordan, that things were this bad. So I just started walking the streets. I went back to the shelter and asked them if they knew of some of Emma's favorite spots, and they were willing to tell me that. So I started walking the streets and walking down different areas, walking along the beach, going to places, to the marina, for instance, going to all the places where Emma was known to hang out, like the public library and those places. So I did that for the first couple of days. Then I realized that it wasn't going to be a simple matter of turning a corner and seeing her. So we didn't have any recent photos of her because she had been traveling and she'd been all over, so we didn't have any updated photographs of Emma. So I went back to the shelter and asked them if they had any photographs, and by luck they had one, because one of the things that they do is take a picture of someone when they come in. So I had one picture, so I made up a poster of that one picture and I started postering the city of Victoria. I just plastered the city with posters.
As Shelley was blanketing Victoria with missing persons posters and slowly putting together a team of supporters who were assisting her, One source of information she continued to turn to was the woman's shelter where Emma had last been staying. The only problem was the shelter staff were bound by privacy laws and unable to answer many of the basic questions Shelley had. It took some effort and resulted in her receiving a cease and desist request, but she was able to obtain some valuable information from them.
Well, the technique was fairly straightforward because I didn't have to put on an act. I was a mother in distress. Tears came easily. So I would go and talk to them and ask them what they thought might have happened and slowly but surely ask them, you know, well, what do you mean she changed in the last little while? And they say, well, we're not supposed to talk about it. And I say, well, just off the record, if you could just give me an example of how she might have changed. Don't be specific. Don't give me, you know, times or dates. But I was, I think I came across as the person I was, which was a very vulnerable, distressed mother. And I broke down in tears every time I went to the shelter. And I think that, a number of the frontline shelter staff, I think they were compassionate enough that they felt that they just needed to help me. So they did divulge things that I found out later that they should not have, and I think they were chastised for it. I know I was chastised for going to the shelter and was told that I was no longer welcome there. But I found out a lot about her mental state through the frontline staff at the Merriman shelter.
Still using her hotel and a downtown library as a sort of home base, Shelley and her team of supporters follow every lead they can find and engage the local media, hoping the news coverage will assist in locating Emma. The first major break would come in 1 week after Emma's disappearance. The $200 prepaid credit card turned up. It was being used by a man to buy cigarettes at a local gas station.
Again, this is somewhat of a bizarre story, and I have conflicting stories. I was told by the police that the card was found on the side of the road by a man who went into, I believe, a gas station and used it to buy cigarettes. Now, the police gave me a very specific location as to where this card had been found, that this gentleman had apparently told them exactly where he had found the card. I'm going to go out on a limb and say I believe it was in Langford, but it was outside of Victoria, not in the city of Victoria. And this is what the police had told me, and that was on December 5th that he used the card. When he actually found it, I'm not sure, but he used it on December 5th. You can imagine my elation when I found out that the card had been used. I assumed it had been used by Emma. I was ecstatic until I found out that it was somebody else. I believe he was polygraphed, and he was cleared. So what's really, really odd about this part of the puzzle, Jordan, is that the person who found the card's name is Mike. And Mike phoned me, and he phoned me on three different occasions. And the first time he called, he could barely speak. He said, I'm just really scared. I'm really nervous to be calling you, to be talking to you. I don't know if I should be. So all I'm going to do is just let you know that I'm Mike and I'm the person who found the card. Second time he calls, we have a similar conversation, except that he says what the police have told you about where I found the card is not true. That's not where I found the card. Third conversation, he says to me, he says, I'm a recovering alcoholic. I don't know where I found the card. I said, Mike, the police gave me a specific location. He said, well, I don't know why they gave you a specific location because I don't even know where I found it. So I found that very puzzling, very bizarre. You know, your natural instinct would be to believe the police. Yes, this man's a recovering alcoholic. You could tell he was extremely shaky, extremely nervous talking to me. But to go out of his way to make three phone calls to me to tell me that card was not where the police claimed it to be, I just found that a very strange thing to have happen. So to this day, I don't know where the card was found.
With the discovery of the credit card, an odd character is introduced in the case, but nothing in the way of useful new information is gained. The pay-as-you-go cell phone that Emma purchased was looked into as well. To this day, it's never been found, but it was determined to never have been activated, thus never having been used. The other obvious avenue of investigation was Emma's bank account. After her purchase of the pay-as-you-go phone at 5:54 p.m., the account has never been touched, despite it carrying a balance in the area of $3,000. As the search would roll on, Shelley next would begin the task of sorting through the personal belongings Emma left behind. Most notably, Emma's extensive journals were pored over in hopes that they would hold a clue that may lead to her location. Shelley described these journals in our conversation.
Emma was a very prolific writer. She had thousands of pages of journaling, of writing, short stories, all kinds of things, poems. They were all written very poetically. It was very hard to really understand what her intention was in some of her writings. Her penmanship was an art form in itself, so very, very difficult to get through these hundreds and thousands of pages. But what I gained from reading her journals was that what I read into them was that she was not well emotionally. There were a lot of things that she said in her journals that indicated to me that she was really not well, that she had perhaps had an emotional, psychological breakdown.
The journals, which were said to be more poetic and artistic than specific and organized, provided little new leads. That said, one piece of writing was especially concerning and is often discussed when theorizing the outcome of Emma's actions. This entry, which was more so a poem, on its surface bears some resemblance to a suicide note. This writing was dated November 28, 2011, 1 year to the day before Emma's disappearance. And oddly, this was one of the very few entries that she did date. Here's a reading of the poem provided by a listener of the Nighttime Podcast.
To everyone, from Dead Emma. Hello. I figure someone will be on this computer at some point and will read this. Okay, so I'm dead, floating about on energy or not, watching dying stars, reviving stars, dreaming milky dreams and shadow dancing on your timelines or whatever. Good luck, every heart. I love you. M.
During our conversation, Shelley provided her thoughts on what this poem's intended meaning was.
Well, when I first came across it, I panicked and assumed it was a suicide note. But then after I read it a couple of times, I thought, I don't know so much that it's a suicide note as a last will and testament, which does not indicate suicide. I think she just wanted to be sure that certain people received certain things that were precious to her. I mean, it says, you know, from Dead Emma, which is, an odd approach. At first it startled me and it scared me, but I didn't carry that around in my heart, and I don't now as a suicide note. I think it was intended more to be a last will and testament. I don't feel that it was a suicide note.
When all the information is looked at, the initial phone calls to Shelley, Emma's need for the woman's shelter, the puzzling writings Shelley found in the journals, and Emma's unusual behavior on the day of her disappearance, it became clear to Shelley that Emma was mentally unwell and was facing some sort of crisis. I had asked Shelley about her thoughts on her daughter's mental health, and she described the troubling picture that formed as the search was ongoing.
Well, aside from the journals, I was able to get a great deal of information, actually, from Sandy Merriman, Woman's Shelter. I was relentless. I went back over, and as I said, I went back over and over again until I was told to cease and desist. And they described some pretty bizarre behaviors. And they said that the behaviors had started roughly 2 weeks prior to the phone calls to me starting. They weren't specific in their description of how she had changed, but they said she has changed dramatically. She is no longer the Emma we knew. There was an Emma, and now there's a new Emma. And she is not at all. She carries no similarities to the Emma we know. They describe things like her moving furniture out of the shelter onto the lawn. They would move it back in, and a couple of days later she would move it out onto the sidewalk. Eventually she moved some of the furniture onto the courthouse steps, all the while telling the staff members that there were voices, that the furniture was talking. saying things and bothering her, and she needed to get rid of it. They described at one point that they had actually become afraid of her. Now, to be afraid of Emma is unheard of. It was such a startling comment. I said, in what way? They said, well, she just wasn't herself. She was just acting so odd that we didn't want to turn our backs on her. I asked if she had shown any signs of violent behavior, and they said, oh, no, none at all. But yet, they said that they had become afraid of her. Based on that, those descriptions of Emma's behavior, I think Emma became paranoid schizophrenic. Became a paranoid schizophrenic. I think that explains her paranoid behavior at the 7-Eleven. I think it explains her paranoid behavior, not wanting to walk to the construction site. I think she had a break with reality.
When Shelley originally arrived in Victoria, she'd only planned to stay for a brief time, basically collect her daughter and return to Ontario. But as time passed and the investigation failed to show any sign Emma was likely to be found in the near future, Shelley was faced with the unimaginable task of deciding when she should leave Victoria and return home without her missing daughter. At the time of her disappearance, Emma's employer, a popular seafood retailer called Redfish Bluefish, was closed for their seasonal break. Shelley decided that if Emma was still in Victoria, maybe she'd show up for her shift when the store reopened. If Emma didn't, she would leave. In the next segment, Shelley will describe some of the emotions she was faced with when after 2 months, she checked out of the hotel to return home where the rest of the Philippoffs were in need of their mother's care.
I wasn't prepared to come home, to be honest, but my family really urged me to. They were very concerned about Emma, of course, but they were also becoming very concerned about me and my state of mind. I set a date. I decided that Emma had promised Redfish Bluefish that she would return to work on February 1st, which was a seasonal restaurant, which was the date that they had set to open, and she had promised that she would return to work. So I thought, well, I'm going to wait and see if she does show up for work. And if she doesn't show up for work, then I guess I will listen to my family and come home. Because I mean, I had a son who was an older teenager, but he was living alone in the house, worried sick about his sister, worried sick about his mother, and he was living alone because my husband and I had separated. So he was in this big empty house trying to take care of the three dogs and the three cats and go to school and go to work and stay positive and stay strong. So my oldest daughter and my ex-husband convinced me that I really needed to come home. So it was very difficult for me, Jordan. I felt like I was leaving her behind. But I felt that their reasoning was valid. So I came back to Ontario.
Despite Shelley ending her boots-on-the-ground search in Victoria, from her home in Ontario, she continued to work with her team of investigators, now using the Help Find Emma Philippoff Facebook group as a home base. As word continued to spread online of her search for Emma, some promising leads surfaced. The first was a photo someone shared on the Facebook group of a young woman sitting in a coffee shop in Vancouver. She was writing in a journal. The woman pictured bears an uncanny resemblance to Emma. In fact, saying she resembles Emma would be understating it. Shelley will walk us through this.
The photo of the girl in the coffee shop was absolutely overwhelming. It was a better likeness of Emma than some of the photos that we had of her. Because I'm sure you've noticed that she's almost chameleon-like, that she is different looking at every single photo of her. Yeah, she changes her hair, she cuts her bangs, she puts her hair on the side, she puts her hair up, she changes her dress style, whatever, and suddenly Emma looks like a completely different person. That young woman in the coffee shop actually looked more like Emma than some of the pictures that we actually had of Emma. It was just, when I saw that, I thought, we found Emma. We found Emma, that's her. Didn't look like what she would wear, but I thought we found her, and I took the pictures to my ex-husband and showed him, and he said, well, that's Emma. And he's an artist. I mean, he has an artist's eye, and he said, yeah, that's Emma. Then I put up on Facebook with the person, blah, 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 in the person in the photograph sitting at the coffee shop and, you know, dated and all that. If you know who this person is, would you please come forward? And within a couple of days, someone got a hold of me and gave me the name of the person in the photograph. And I asked that they put me in touch with her. And she assured me that it was her. And she sent me a number of photographs of herself. Now, oddly enough, she didn't look like Emma in any of them except for one. It required a profile picture for her to look like Emma. But it was really, really demoralizing because it looked so much like Emma that we thought it was Emma.
The next tip would introduce another suspicious character and add another strange piece of video footage to this story. This tip came in the form of a 911 call from a concerned store owner who had an encounter with an angry man holding one of Emma's crumpled up missing persons posters and claiming she was his girlfriend and that she didn't want to be found. People involved in this case have come to refer to him as the green shirt guy due to the green shirt he's seen wearing in the surveillance footage.
Green shirt guy haunts me. The green shirt, we call him the green shirt guy for lack of a better name because he had a green t-shirt on. He walked into a store in Vancouver, a store called Glitz, and it was a clothing novelty type store. And in his hand, he was crumpling up a poster, a missing poster of Emma. And angry, he had an angry walk about him, and he had anger in his voice, and he said to the owner, this woman's not missing. Emma's not missing. Emma's my girlfriend, and she's not missing. She just doesn't want to have anything to do with her family, and crumpled it up and just threw it onto the counter at the cash. And then he proceeded to wander through the store, and he held out a piece of clothing and said, oh, this would fit Emma. Emma's really small. This would fit her. And then he turned around and walked out. They immediately called 911. Unfortunately, 911 took their sweet time getting to the store, and by then the green shirt guy had long disappeared. He was long gone. So we've had him up on Facebook. We've done all kinds of things to try to track him down, and nobody has come forward willing to identify him. And yet he's quite distinctive looking. I'm pretty sure I would recognize him. But he was angry. He was angry just that there was this missing poster of his supposed girlfriend, and that, in fact, that she just wanted to be left alone. She just didn't want to have any interaction. She didn't want to have anything to do with her family.
With the search still on for the green shirt guy, there's been little in the way of new information. It's at this point that Shelley managed to gain much more attention for Emma's case than she had been able to previously. It's with her ability to engage the media that her message went from being pinned to a telephone pole to being broadcast across the country. Anyone who's been following Emma Philipoff's case is well aware of the CBC-produced Fifth Estate documentary called Finding Emma. I asked Shelley what led to this production.
What I did was, I have a friend who works for CBC Radio, and I spoke to her and I said, you know, I've got to get the story out, and I've got to get it out in a big way. I'm thinking of the Fifth Estate or W5. And she said, well, I would go with Fifth Estate. And she had her reasons for it. Well, probably partly because she worked for CBC. So she said, if I were you, I would write to Lyndon McIntyre. She said he's the most compassionate of the journalists on the show. He is probably your best bet to maybe kind of win over and have him become interested in the story. So what I did, Jordan, was I just sat down and I wrote Lyndon McIntyre an email. And I tried to make it as simple, as straightforward, and as compassionate and as urgent as I could. And within a couple of days, sure enough, he was in touch with me and he said, I'm more than interested in your story. Let's do it. And it was that simple. And I asked him why he was so quickly willing to do a story on Emma. He said there was just something, and I think it's because I described Emma. And nobody can turn Emma down. and I described Emma, who she was as a person, and I think he was drawn to her, and that's how simple it was. And then from there on, we worked on, it wasn't Lyndon that actually, it was Mark Kelly, who was the journalist that actually did the work. But originally it was supposed to be Lyndon McIntyre, and he did a lot of the footwork ahead of time, and he pushed it through CBC and got it on the Fifth Estate.
As producers prepared the Finding Emma documentary, another puzzling character would be introduced to the case. In fact, the Fifth Estate would focus an entire segment of the documentary to their suspicions of this one-time friend of Emma's. His name is Julian. A year prior to Emma's disappearance, he had met her in Ontario and showed a romantic interest in her, which is said to have been turned down. In an odd coincidence, Julian moved to Victoria 3 months prior to her disappearance. After she went missing, some unread Facebook messages were found in Emma's dad's inbox that Julian had sent prior to her disappearance. In the messages, Julian had apologized for having stalked her previously and asked for assistance in getting in touch with her again in Victoria. Shelley told me a bit about Julian and what made him seem suspicious.
Well, to be honest, there are only a couple of things that really would lead someone to think of Julian as a possible suspect in some way. The fact that he moved to Victoria a while after Emma had moved there struck a lot of people, including myself, as very suspicious. He said he just arbitrarily picked a city on the West Coast, and then he just arbitrarily picked Victoria, and what a surprise to find Emma there. Well, it seems like an awful big coincidence to me. So that was the first thing that kind of alerted people to the fact that something didn't seem quite right. I mean, with all the places on the West Coast that he could have chosen, that he chose. I mean, Victoria's a small city. You know, if it had been Vancouver, you know, well, maybe. But, I mean, Victoria, I mean, it's a little island. That was something that drew suspicion. And then we later on discover Facebook messages that he had sent to my ex-husband trying to track Emma down, in which he himself uses the word stalker. He said, I want to apologize for having stalked your daughter. That was kind of alarming. So those were the two main reasons that Julian ever became a suspicious character. And then I must admit that I found it odd that he was so quick to track me down. I mean, how he knew I was in the city, I'm not quite sure. I don't know if there had been media coverage yet at that point, but he tracked me down very, very quickly, and he had never met me. And I was in the library on one of the computers because I knew that Emma spent a lot of time there, so I thought, I'm going to sit at a computer station and I can see the front door so I can watch for Emma to come in. And I noticed this young man staring at me. And finally I got up and went over and I said, do you know me? Do I know you? Can I help you? And then he went on to introduce himself and explain who he was. And I found that odd, Jordan. I found that odd that he had spent enough time looking at my Facebook page to be able to pick me out of a fairly large group of people sitting at computer stations, having never met me, in a city where you wouldn't expect to see me. I found that a little bit odd.
As the Finding Emma documentary was broadcast across Canada, Emma's face and story is much more well known. That said, there's been little in the way of new information despite this increased exposure. The search, however, hasn't slowed down. Using an internal power that I can't even imagine, Shelley has dedicated her life to the pursuit of her daughter. I asked her to describe the day-to-day of the current search.
I have a great group of volunteers. I have a team of volunteers who are absolutely wonderful, and I don't know what I would do without them in terms of moral support and feet on the ground expression, feet on the ground kind of help that they offer. That's my job, is constantly be looking for ways of keeping Emma in the public eye. So yes, one of the things that I did was I hired a company to put up billboards of Emma in different places, different locations. There was one in Victoria just at the ferry, maybe one in Kelowna. Anyways, I paid for 3 or 4 months, and then by luck, there was a month where no one had bought the space, so we got a free month. So the bulletin board was up, I think, for 4, if not 5 months. Unfortunately, nothing came of it. We continue with the Facebook page, and then we keep that up to date. And I try to keep people engaged. Well, I don't write a blog. I've tried writing a blog. It's too painful, to be honest. I'm in the public eye a lot, which is great, and that's what I need. But, you know, for some people, a day is just another day. But for me, I have to find a way to get through that day. I've chosen not to write a blog, but what I do on Facebook is I put up quotes, I put up songs, I make comments regarding Emma. Every month, I write a poem for the anniversary, for the 28th of whatever month it is. Just recently, we put together a press kit and sent it out to, I believe, 32 newspapers across Canada. And in the press kit, there was a press release describing updated information, a new in-depth timeline. It was detailing Emma's year in Victoria leading up to the day of her disappearance. There was a poster, and then the press release, of course, that explained what was going on. It re-explained Emma's story, basically retold Emma's story. We now have an Emma a discussion group that people have to request to join, and that's grown quite a bit in size. And that's always interesting because people bring up ideas that perhaps we haven't thought about. So right now we're at the point where we're hoping that these press kits garner some attention.
If this is your first time hearing Emma's story, you're likely thinking about how you can get involved. I asked Shelley the best way for us to assist her, and here's some of what she said.
They can join the Emma Filipov discussion group, stay up to date with what's going on. I encourage people to share any post that is on Emma's Facebook page. I noticed that a lot of people will click like but not share. We really appreciate the like, but it's the share that's going to get the story out there. Because for every share, hundreds or thousands more people get to see it. And that's the idea, is to have hundreds of thousands of people seeing her story, seeing her face. Because somebody somewhere knows something. She didn't just disappear. She couldn't just vanish. Somebody has to know something, Jordan. Somebody has to know something.
And if anyone has any information they think may be useful to you, what's the best way for somebody to contact you?
Either private message me on her Facebook page or send me an email. My email is very simple. It's philipoff@hotmail.com.
We will end this episode with that message by Shelley, but I'd like to echo her statement. For anyone interested in staying up to date on the case and supporting Shelley, I encourage you to join the Help Find Emma Filipov Facebook group. And if you'd like to assist in theorizing and providing opinions, join the Help Find Emma Filipov discussion group on Facebook. Please share her story, and if anyone knows anything they think may be helpful, please get in touch with Shelley. As I mentioned at the beginning of this episode, I am planning to cover this story via an ongoing series. At present, I'm planning at least 5 more episodes related to Emma Filipov's disappearance that will be released in the coming months. If you are interested in hearing more content from the Nighttime Podcast, you may be interested in joining the Nighttime Patron Group, where for $1 a month, you'll have access to a monthly bonus episode. You can join by visiting patreon.com/nighttimepodcast. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Nighttime Podcast. If you have a moment and you'd like to help support the show, please rate, review, and subscribe on whichever podcast platform you prefer. It may seem insignificant to do that, but it really helps spread the word of the show. Also, to stay up to date, please follow me at facebook.com/nighttimepodcast or on Twitter or Instagram, where my handle is @nighttimepod. If you have any story ideas or any feedback for the show, I'd love to hear from you at nighttimepodcast@gmail.com. I look forward to talking to you again soon.
The Nighttime Podcast is written, hosted, and produced by Jordan Bonaparte. Copyright Jordan Bonaparte.